You're listening to the Takeaway Podcast. You can also find us on Twitter at The Takeaway and on Facebook at facebook.com/The Takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And it is a day like few others in world history. South Africa is the world today, you might say. The memorial service for Nelson Mandela, more than 90 world leaders in attendance today on a rainy day that did nothing to dampen spirits, on a stage in front of tens of thousands, in a ceremony watched by millions. We'll give you a bit of a sense of that memorial in Johannesburg and use it to launch a few conversations this hour. We will examine the qualities of myth in our lives and the reality of vulnerability. Nelson Mandela was a champion of the powerless in his country. This hour, we will see how the myth of racial identity in America has made people vulnerable, been an engine of poverty. And then we'll have a very real look at homelessness through the eyes of a young girl here in New York City. But we start at the FNB Stadium in Johannesburg, the site of the 2010 World Cup, where the world was again focused today. Four American presidents were in attendance, Presidents Carter, Clinton, along with Hillary Clinton, President George W. Bush, President Obama, along with First Lady Michelle Obama, all honoring and remembering Nelson Mandela and looking within themselves.
For the people of South Africa, for those he inspired around the globe, Madiba's passing is rightly a time of mourning and a time to celebrate a heroic life. But I believe it should also prompt in each of us a time for self-reflection. With honesty, regardless of our station or our circumstance, we must ask, how well have I applied his lessons in my own life?
President Obama took those words to heart in a moment where he took the initiative to shake the hand of Cuban leader Raul Castro, a bit of reconciliation and history on a historic day. But there was little reconciliation for current South African President Jacob Zuma, who faced a tough crowd during his concluding speech, a reminder that without Mandela, the job of reconciliation in the current political environment in South Africa will be difficult for anyone.
When a man has done what he considers to be his duty to his people and his country, he can rest in peace. I believe I've made that effort. And that is, therefore, why I will sleep for eternity. Unquote. Lala ngoxolo Madiba, qhawe la maqhawe.
South African President Jacob Zuma addressing the crowd in Zulu at the conclusion of his speech, during which, by the way, the hashtag Zuma Booze was distinctly trending upward.
My name is Meg Gardiner. I'm a professor at Florida International University in Miami, Florida. And I think that the legacy of Nelson Mandela has to do with two of his greatest ideas. First, nonviolence, and second is education. He said that education is the most powerful weapon which you can use to change the world. But he chose not to take up weapons. His weapon was nonviolence.
Thanks, Meg. One of you out there, part of the conversation of Mandela's legacy and work we must take up here in the U.S. This hour, a discussion of mythology, freedom, and the most powerless among us. Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Since the September 11th, 2001 attacks on the U.S., there has been a huge unraveling of this nation's understanding of what constitutes freedom and what constitutes defense and security. Our understanding of what the government is permitted to do to watch over Americans, what Americans expect from their government to prevent terrorism, and how politicians and technology have exploited all of this to grow a massive surveillance infrastructure unmatched in the world, all of this is quickly evolving and mostly behind the scenes, and it is one of the great stories of the 21st century. But there were moments like this in March 2013.
So what I wanted to see is if you could give me a yes or no answer to the question, does the NSA collect any type of data at all on millions or hundreds of millions of Americans?
No, sir.
It does not.
Not wittingly. There are cases where they could inadvertently, perhaps, collect, but not wittingly.
Not wittingly. Two words that should go down in the history of the English language. That's James Clapper essentially lying to Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, director of National Intelligence Courses, who James Clapper is. Ron Wyden is the Oregon senator on the Intelligence Committee who has championed the issue of government intervention and government surveillance of U.S. citizens. Ryan Lizza is the New Yorker's Washington correspondent. He writes about this moment and a lot more in this week's magazine. Ryan, welcome to the program.
Hey, thank you very much for having me.
In many ways, this hearing, this moment in March of 2013 is the beginning of a gigantic kind of reveal that we now understand in the Snowden memos, we now understand is a gigantic series of campaigns by the NSA and the security establishment to look at the business and communications of Americans. Yes?
Yes, that's a seminal moment because that's sort of the culmination of a lot of work by Ron Wyden for about a decade to do everything he can to release more information about these programs. And we learned from some of the interviews with Snowden after the fact that he saw that hearing and it influenced him, and he had some very harsh things to say about Clapper after that hearing.
And the layering of the various programs, if we begin with September 11th as the kind of beginning of a relook at what was settled during hearings in the 1970s about domestic surveillance, controversial hearings that really restrained the CIA, created the FISA court system. After September 11th, there were a series of different kinds of programs that America heard about piecemeal that hinted at a lot of this. Can you describe that narrative as best you can?
Yeah, and that's what I tried to do with this piece, is to go back and remind people that all of this started after 9/11, and some of it came out in the Bush years, but the Snowden documents, and frankly some of the documents that the intelligence community has declassified since the Snowden release, if you go back and read through what is now thousands of pages of unauthorized leaks and declassified documents, you can tell a somewhat familiar story with an incredible amount of detail. That's what I tried to do in this piece. And basically, after 9/11, the Bush administration started four collection programs. And these programs were started outside of the legal authority that the NSA had been operating under before. A lot of people believe it was unconstitutional for them to start these programs. And this became known back in 2005 as Bush's warrantless wiretapping program. Everyone remembers that. And these programs were basically, they tried to bring them under the umbrella of the law in a period from 2004 to 2007 by using various authorities within the Patriot Act. And then eventually Congress stepped in and sort of codified one of the programs, the content collection program, which is sort of phone wiretapping and the contents of emails. That happened in 2008. But the bigger point is that all of what we learned from Snowden started way back in the days after 9/11.
You know, the end of this piece, and really the takeaway from this piece, is the idea that there is now within the U.S. government a culture of complicity where the security establishment really on some level has seduced Congress, the Intelligence Committee, the oversight institutions that were set up in the 70s, and even seduced the White House and the executive branch into being a part of this surveillance, either out of their intent or just the sense of, whoa, this is the cool, secret, awesome stuff. What do you think is going on here?
You know, what I think you have this system of oversight where the FISA court, which was the right thing to set up in the late 70s, and it does work, but the FISA court is very deferential to the intelligence community because, as they say in a lot of opinions, they don't know what is in the best interest to secure the country. The intelligence community does. So that's the FISA court opinion. Then you have the policymakers at the White House. Barack Obama didn't serve in the intelligence committee. He wasn't an expert on these issues. He gets in there and then he defers to the FISA court. And he says, well, if the FISA court says this is okay, I'm okay with it. And then you have the Senate Intelligence Committee and the House Intelligence Committee, also not made up of experts on intelligence matters. Their overriding interest is protecting the country from attack, and they don't want to be the ones who vote against or give the intelligence community a hard time, not giving them a tool they need, and then after the fact someone arguing that it could have prevented an attack. And so you have this, you basically have the intelligence community holding all the cards in terms of what they need to prevent an attack, and nobody wanting to challenge them. And the issue here is that the intelligence community is getting away with whatever they can get the FISA court to tell them is legal, rather than the policymakers sitting down and saying what is in line with our Constitution and our ideals, not just what is technically legal under the Patriot Act and under FISA.
Let's take your card game analogy. So the CIA and the NSA are dealing. But everybody at the table, the judiciary, the policymakers, the White House, the Senate, they can't read the cards. They're playing, and the dealer is the only one that even knows what's on the cards, and the dealer decides who wins.
Absolutely. And in Congress, at least the executive branch, theoretically, the White House should know everything that the intelligence community is doing because it's above it. It's overseeing it. In Congress, Senator Feinstein, who a lot of people, including me, criticize as not being a very effective overseer of this community, she admitted to me, she says, look, we don't even know all the programs because they don't tell us all the programs they have unless you ask very specific questions. So you have this game up in Congress where unless they can guess exactly the right question to ask, they don't know how to get the answers. And so you have the courts, Congress, and the White House all deferring to the intelligence community, which claims that they have the expertise. And what you need basically is policymakers with the confidence of the intelligence community, with the same level of confidence about these programs, and to have a little bit more of a broader debate about the balance between security and liberty, rather than just deferring all the time to the heads of the intelligence agency, who are at the end of the day, if you were at the NSA, your job is really not to be a constitutional scholar on the Fourth Amendment. Your job is to vacuum up as much information as you possibly can to prevent terrorist attacks. And you can't necessarily blame them from having their view. It's not their responsibility to have that self-restraint. It's Congress and the White House and the FISA court to rein them in. And hopefully that's the discussion that we have right now.
The system created in the 70s definitely needs a reexamination for the 21st century. Ryan Lizza, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you, John. I really appreciate it.
Ryan Lizza is Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. His piece on the CIA, the NSA, and the culture of complicity is in this week's magazine. Another debate over government authority over Americans has roots in the 1970s. At issue in the Supreme Court today, who has the power to act on issues of controlling environmental hazards? Is Congress the supreme authority or the Environmental Protection Agency created by Congress back in the 1970s? 4 years ago, the EPA declared that it had the power to regulate carbon dioxide because of the scientific consensus over its role in contributing to global warming. It was a declaration of war to some members of Congress, a war on Congress.
Families and workers in my state don't want to see the lost jobs, the higher energy costs that EPA's big government takeover of carbon regulations would bring.
Whether or not Congress or unelected bureaucrats at the EPA should set climate policy for this country.
We believe that is our job.
And the cost of this Washington power grab by the EPA, American jobs, plain and simple.
And agencies realize they can't overreach.
Collection of Republican lawmakers there speaking a few years back when the EPA said it could regulate carbon. Today, one aspect of the growing power of the EPA is being challenged before the court, the so-called good neighbor provision of the Clean Air Act that permits the EPA to enforce state-to-state pollution controls. The federal government can intervene with states that contribute to the pollution of their downwind neighbors. Joining us to talk about all of this is Jeff Holmstead, former assistant administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency under George W. Bush, now an attorney with the firm Bracewell & Giuliani. Mr. Holmstead, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So, Mr. Homestead, as a former Bush administration official, can you explain to me how the EPA under the Bush administration is different or similar to the EPA under the Obama administration?
Well, both the Bush EPA and the Obama EPA are implementing the same laws. And during the Bush administration, air quality continued to improve. And so I can say in terms of environmental protection, both administrations take the Clean Air Act very seriously. I think it is fair to say that the Obama administration has been much more aggressive in using the Clean Air Act to target coal-fired power plants.
Before we talk about coal-fired power plants, what do you make of this challenge of the good neighbor provision? There has to be a way to regulate state-to-state emissions because of the way the winds blow, right?
Oh, I think there's no question about that. Air pollution crosses state lines, and really almost all states contribute to some degree to air quality in nearby states. The question really is how aggressive EPA can be in doing that. And in this particular case, EPA really usurped the role that states have traditionally had by going in and regulating companies directly, and also regulating really far beyond what is justified based on air quality concerns. EPA took the view that it essentially could regulate as far as it deemed was reasonable without really considering the impact that one state has on the other. So I think there's agreement that EPA can step in to deal with what's called cross-state air pollution. But the question here is whether they went too far.
Now, what is too far? Because is this a constitutional question? Is that what takes precedence here? States should have the rights to regulate their own internal industries. Or is there an overriding concern about the environment, which affects every one of us?
It's actually much narrower than that. It simply has to do with whether EPA properly interpreted certain provisions of the Clean Air Act. A lot of people, I think, really don't understand that EPA is limited. EPA doesn't have independent authority. It can only implement statutory provisions that have been adopted by Congress. Now, EPA can be creative in interpreting those provisions, and that's what EPA has done with the carbon regulations. I think everyone agrees that Congress didn't intend EPA to use the Clean Air Act to regulate carbon dioxide.
Although Congress had no idea that global warming was on the horizon or that there would be a scientific consensus about carbon and global warming either.
No, I think that's true. But the question is, when a new issue like that emerges, can EPA take it upon itself, or is it in the first instance up to Congress and the president to come up with the right approach for dealing with that?
Do you think there's a legal battle brewing this year and over the next few years between Congress and the EPA that will be played out in the U.S. Supreme Court?
I don't know if the big cases over carbon dioxide and carbon pollution will be heard this year or even next year. EPA has embarked on a fairly aggressive regulatory program, but even so, it takes a while for EPA to develop these rules and then for those rules to wend their way through the court. So we will be seeing these battles at some point, but probably not for a year or two.
Can I ask you a philosophical question, Jeff Homestead?
Sure.
You know, we've seen this hour in this program a discussion of just how controversial the question of whether national security trumps the Constitution and the issue of the NSA surveillance. We also, down through history, have had a debate over whether equal rights and racial equality trumps sort of state-to-state provisions about enforcement of laws. In the case of national security, we're unclear as to what happens. In the case of racial equality, the federal government does have authority over the states. We're just beginning to deal with this in terms of the environment. Do you see a theme here?
Well, I'm not sure I really tie it to national security, but there is an understanding that many environmental issues really are local issues. If you're talking about waste disposal, for example. There's really not much of an argument that the disposal of waste has environmental impacts beyond the immediate community. However, on some of these other issues, and air pollution is the classic example, what happens in one state can impact another state, and the way our laws are set up does allow the federal government to deal with that. But there are likely to be continuing controversies over really how far the government can go and the role of states versus the role of EPA.
And we're seeing that played out today in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Jeff Holmstead, thanks so much.
Oh, my pleasure.
Jeff Holmstead is a former assistant administrator for the Environmental Protection Agency, now an attorney with the firm Bracewell & Giuliani in Washington. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. One more thought on Washington. Joining us now, Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent. Todd, welcome.
Hi, John.
So, Todd, apparently there is an agreement now on the defense authorization bill, but within that bill, a couple of controversial provisions. Explain.
Well, John, the House and Senate, and indeed the whole Congress, have been debating for months the DOD authorization bill. It's been a bit of a mess. We don't have to get into why. You can probably figure out a lot of it yourself, spending and other things. But the issue of military sexual assault, of course, has been a giant issue in the media, in the military, on this show, as several senators, including Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and others, have tried to raise new standards. John, there were 3,553 reports of sexual assault between July 2012 and July of 2013 in the military. That's a 43% increase from the year before. Nobody knows if that's even a good estimate because, of course, most or many of the cases don't go reported at the same time.
And that's part of the controversy. The question is, does this come outside of the chain of command or stay within the chain of command in terms of oversight? And the Gillibrand bill was one view, but there are a lot of people, including the head of the Defense Armed Services Committee, who takes another view of all of that. How did it shake out?
Yeah, that's true. So you got an agreement between the leaders on this issue because they ran out of time to pass a bill. The result, Gillibrand was out of the discussion, and there's a new discussion out. Now, they have a lot of new standards, however, that are in this bill, not the Gillibrand standard. But here's Senator Carl Levin. He's of Michigan. He's talking about the UCMJ here, the Uniform Code of Military Justice. That's military law for service members. Talking about one of the provisions in the new standards, and we'll talk about some others. Listen.
The threat of retaliation has been one of the reasons why victims do not report the assaults or the improper contacts or sexual behavior. So we make in this bill now that's going to be introduced in the next couple of days in the House and then hopefully get to the Senate, retaliation is a crime under the UCMJ.
A crime, meaning if a senior officer retaliates against someone who reports a sexual assault under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, that's now a crime, according to this. But this falls short of the toughness of the language of some of the real advocates of dealing with the sexual assault issue.
Well, it does. Senator Gillibrand and others wanted military prosecutors, not commanders, to decide who gets prosecuted, which complaints are taken seriously or seriously enough to proceed with a court-martial or other military discipline. That's not in here because Levin and many other senators on the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House counterpart really took their cues from the brass here at the Pentagon, who wanted to keep this process in the chain of command to say unit cohesion is at stake if commanders still don't have complete control over the troops. But we should say, even though Gillibrand lost on that factor, there are a lot of other things that this agreement does if it's accepted by the House and Senate, and we'll see if people vote for this. Commanders can't dismiss anymore a finding by a jury in a court-martial. Used to be a commander could do that. They can't anymore in the case of military sexual assault. Victims can request a transfer or a relocation if they accuse another member in their unit or on their base of a sexual assault. It eliminates a five-year statute of limitations where alleged perpetrators could get out from under a charge before. There are new minimum sentencing guidelines. And also, if you're convicted of a sexual assault under these provisions, you're out. Dishonorable discharge from the military.
But still, it's so interesting a theme today in this program. The military sort of dictating to Congress what it wants, getting its way. Security establishment doing the same to the White House on the Senate Intelligence Committee. One final detail. There's a Gitmo detail in this bill before we go.
The bill, John, includes provisions for relocating detainees who are released from Gitmo only to other countries. That old debate about interning them here or trying them in the United States explicitly forbids any of those detainees at Gitmo, if they're released, from coming to the United States.
Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
Pleasure.
So one of the arresting images in the continuing unrest in Ukraine was the smashing of a historic statue of Lenin into a pile of rubble in the center of Kiev. It was a move a member of parliament called the end of the Soviet occupation, which, by my calendar, actually ended in the late 80s, and the beginning of the final decolonization of Ukraine. Joining us to explain the symbolic significance of this statue's undoing is Sasha Senderovich, who's assistant professor of Russian studies and Jewish studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder. Welcome, professor.
Hello, John.
So is this a bit of a historical footnote that took a little while for them to get the hammers out there in Ukraine, or does this bear direct significance on what's going on in Ukraine?
So it's very interesting what you said in the introduction, because if you were on various news channels and reading things about this on Sundays, as the event was happening, the headlines, including in Western media, were really fascinating. You would see headlines like, you know, the statue of Lenin toppled in Ukraine, and you were thinking as if it were 1989 or 1991, as if this late Cold War moment was still with us. But this is two decades after the end of the Cold War. So, of course, it's very interesting to see whether this is a kind of playing out of something that wasn't finished back then, or whether two decades after the significance of Lenin as exemplifying the kind of the Soviet regime that had fallen then is maybe somewhat belated. So one of the interesting things is, to think about what other meanings have accrued over time that have been ascribed to the statue.
And some of those meanings, those new meanings, have been inflated directly in echoes from Russia itself. It seems to me, on some level, Vladimir Putin has resurrected a notion of the strong state Stalinist regime without actually using those words. So in some sense, has Russia inflated the significance of statues of Lenin around the old Soviet Empire so that when they fall down, they become bigger news?
Yes, I think there's definitely part of that in there. And if we think about what's going on in the memorial landscape in Russia itself, well, first of all, I must say that it's very interesting to think about the etymology. I teach literatures, so I want to think about these things. In English, you know, statue, the root comes down to Latin, which really means to stand. Whereas in Russian and Ukrainian, the word is pamятник, where at the root we have memory. Commemoration, something that commemorates. So we're dealing with a kind of very complicated post-Soviet memorial landscape. So the most interesting example to your listeners probably would be in Moscow, Cathedral of Christ the Savior, which was built first in the 1880s to commemorate the soldiers who died in the War of 1812 against Napoleon. The cathedral was very famously destroyed by Stalin in the 1930s, and in its place was going to be built the Palace of the Soviets, the biggest structure in the world, topped by a giant statue of Lenin. I don't remember the exact scale, but Lenin's toe was something like 6 meters long. It was going to be giant. It was never built because the foundation couldn't hold. And instead, it was turned into a swimming pool, Olympic-sized swimming pool in Moscow. After the fall of the Soviet Union, the cathedral was rebuilt in the same place. And we saw this cathedral in the news 2 years ago when the feminist collective, Pussy Riot, have performed their anti-Putin song in this cathedral, hitting precisely at the nexus of the kind of post-Soviet imagery that the resurrection of this cathedral meant for state power in Russia, and how this cathedral placed in this very contested site meant the sort of return of the Russian Orthodox Church, but in the same fashion as if it were still a very Stalinist kind of thinking.
Changeable myths and symbols in turbulent times. You remind me that those ancient Buddhist statues in Afghanistan were dynamited by the Taliban as anti-Islamic symbols the moment before the 9/11 attacks on the U.S. The political significance of statues and their desecration, details not to be overlooked. Sasha, thanks so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Sasha Senderovich is assistant professor of Russian studies and Jewish studies at the University of Colorado at Boulder.
Given the political language of race in America, it's surprising to note that in the most common narratives of human culture, there is a grand diversity, the polyglot of language and cultures at the Tower of Babel in the Bible. In Roman times, there was lively trade and interaction between the Egyptian empires and the black African Nubians to the south. Romans, Arabs, Egyptians, Greeks, and Nubians together were a no doubt common sight in the ancient world. So it is in this context that the notion of segregation of the races in America and other places is reexamined in a new book on race and its mythology. Segregation of the races was taken for granted during most of American history, enforced by law in America, and also by apartheid law in South Africa, reversed only after a bloody armed struggle in South Africa led by the late Nelson Mandela being memorialized today. In the U.S., change came after a civil war and the often violent civil rights movement of the 20th century. But segregation of the races and an obsession with racial differences culturally and biologically is a construct of our time, and in many ways a peculiarly American construct. Jacqueline Jones is a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin and the author of A Dreadful Deceit, The Myth of Race from the Colonial Era to Obama's America. In her book, Jones says that over time, man-made creation of race has been used to justify our behaviors, but that racial prejudices have no basis in fact or science or even culture.
I found that the earliest colonial slaveholders were not talking about race at all. They were looking for a compliant, cheap, easily exploitable workforce, and they sorted out various kinds of workers, English indentured servants, Irish indentured servants, Native Americans, as well as Africans. And what they found was that Africans were ultimately the most vulnerable and thus the most easily exploitable group, not because of their race, but because they lacked advocates in this Atlantic world of colliding empires. It's not really until the American Revolution that people start to talk about race in a serious way. Thomas Jefferson, a notable example here. And he's obviously seeking to justify the exclusion of a large number of adult men, men of African descent, from the body politic. And the way he thinks he can do that is by defining them as a separate race. So this is a process. People do have to develop this idea over time. They have to rationalize and justify a system of slavery, and they do it by using this concept race. But it's a pretext that comes after the fact.
By the time we get to the Civil War, how well has the mythology worked its way into culture so that it complicates our ability to emancipate the slaves, to do what Lincoln did, and to attempt to make the social changes post-Civil War?
I think the interesting thing about the Civil War is the way that these mythologies are revealed to be very malleable and fluid over time. For instance, before the war in the South, many slaveholders justified slavery by saying that enslaved men and women were childlike, that they were dependent, that they were grateful for white care. Then during the Civil War, the stereotype changes, and suddenly black people are considered subversive to the Confederate cause. They're giving aid and comfort to the enemy, the Union soldiers. And then finally, after the Civil War, a new mythology of race arises, and that is that black people are the dupes of Northern Republicans, that they are unable to think for themselves. They're going to be manipulated by Republicans, and it is imperative then that white Southerners control this group once again under different means now that slavery is over. So we see a great deal of fluidity in these mythologies. They are stories. They are rationalizations concocted by a group of people who benefit from them.
How does race complicate class, and how does class complicate race?
In the sixth of the biographical sketches I include in this book, I look at Simon P. Owens. He wrote under the pseudonym Charles Denby. He was an auto worker in Detroit, born in Alabama in the early 20th century, and he wrestled with this tension. On the one hand, he embraced the cause of the working class in general, and he believed that labor-saving technologies were affecting whites and blacks together, suggesting that they must move forward together to
address these tremendous changes in the workplace. On the other hand, he faced in both radical circles and labor circles this notion that Black people were nothing special. They were part of the working class, and they should not talk about their unique heritage, their unique struggles. They should march lockstep with UAW leaders or radical leaders. And Simon Owens pushed back against that idea. He said, Black people have a unique history, a history that is worth remembering because it has so damaged the structure of many institutions in the United States. In other words, the legacies of these destructive racial mythologies remain with us today in very stark form. And he said to deny that history, to deny these legacies would be a grave mistake.
Of course, Denby is writing in the 60s and 70s, and his words certainly live on, but America has moved on. And in the Obama era, where would you say there are pockets of escaping this narrative in the United States today? And where would you say the clinging to these narratives still exists in politics and in society?
Frankly, I think the clinging to this narrative still exists in our persistent use of the word race. We talk about racial politics, a post-racial society. We talk about race relations. We talk about racial disparities in health and education. We're constantly talking about race, and I liken it to eye color. Suppose we devised a society where people with blue eyes were considered superior to people with brown eyes. Suppose we got rid of legislation that separated people of different eye color. Would we still be invoking eye color as a significant marker of society? I think we should rethink our use of the word race because it reifies the notion that race is real. And in fact, race is a myth. Race is a fiction. Often when people use the word, they're not really talking about biological differences between people. They're talking about a historical process. In the long run, I think it is a destructive trend to continue to use the word at all.
Jacqueline Jones is the author of A Dreadful Deceit, The Myth of Race from the Colonial Era to Obama's America. She's a professor of history at the University of Texas at Austin. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
From the mythologized legacy of Nelson Mandela in South Africa that we spoke about at the beginning of this hour to the myth of racial inferiority kept alive for centuries by American institutions to the reality of who is vulnerable in our time. Who are the powerless, the invisible, the people who inhabit the chilly place that government doesn't reach in our time, that prosperity avoids, that hope cannot change? They're not news, but how they survive, the details of the life of a child whose day begins in a homeless shelter, proceeds to school, and then back not to home, but to homelessness. The details feel new, unfamiliar, just as they are everyday life to the children living this vulnerability, living in this chill. Andrea Elliott is an investigative reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Welcome.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So you discovered this detail of life as a homeless person in New York in your investigation of a young 11-year-old by the name of Dasani. She was on the front page of the paper yesterday, an absolutely arresting picture, an amazing person. You're an investigative reporter. When you encountered her life, her day-to-day life, how amazing was it to see what it is that she had to go through?
Amazing would be the word I would use to describe my daily experience following Dasani and her family through their struggles in New York City. I was constantly amazed and surprised.
You spent a year with them.
Spent more than a year. We started in September of 2012, and we've continued to follow them until the series ran just now. So I'm a New Yorker, and it made me see the city with new eyes.
What city does Dasani see in the course of her day?
Dasani basically sees a city that is out of reach. So what I think is so fascinating about Dasani's experience of poverty and what distinguishes that experience from the experience her mother had, for instance, in Brooklyn, years ago as a child, is that she is in such close proximity to wealth. The shelter where they live is in Fort Greene, Brooklyn, which has been a part of the city's very radical renewal over the last decade. And
oh, there are million-dollar homes on Washington Street in Fort Greene.
$2 million brownstones. Yeah. And it's really been – it's just been transformed. The number of residents jumped – white residents jumped by 80% in the last decade. It's become a place that has, for instance, the block that she spends a lot of time on Myrtle, has a 99-cent store and a fancy wine shop and a very simple deli where you can trade food stamps for cigarettes and a bike repair shop that sells vegan cookies. It's really this fascinating mix of things. And so she's constantly exposed to the things that she cannot have.
What are her possibilities? What does she think of as her possibilities, her
dreams? She's thought of all kinds of things. I mean, it's hard because Dasani is a kid who says she doesn't dream. I think for her, it's very scary to get excited or hopeful because in her experience, when you do that, it gets taken away from you. And that is actually the essence of being homelessness as well, I think, in their experience. You never know what's going to happen the next day, where home will be. You can't get attached. And so in spite of that, I think she does think about things like trying to go to college. Her peers in her school, Susan S. McKinney, which today's story focuses on and the incredible role that that school plays in keeping her really nourished, her peers and a lot of these kids, the vast majority of the middle school children are also from the projects and from families that are poor. They will often talk about sort of drastic escapes like becoming a rap star or a music mogul or an athlete. And as I mentioned in the story, I mean, it does sort of make sense to her that in order to escape this, everything is kind of in extremes here. It's an extreme existence. So she's in extreme poverty. In order to escape it, she needs to do something extreme. But she doesn't really buy into that for herself. She doesn't allow herself to go there.
Do you think she believes in the system in America that it's possible to escape, that if you work hard, get good grades, civically involved, do the right thing?
These are things that children in this community always hear, and they're sort of like ideas that just get repeated so often that they almost become tired or sort of worn.
Insulting, almost.
I think her daily existence is so uncertain and so challenging that she doesn't really think that much about the future. She's very rooted in the present, and when it comes to her assessment of the system, so to speak, it's very interesting because this is a kid who actually is very familiar with city politics and policy decisions just by virtue of the fact that they impact her, that things going on in the city really reach her. For instance, the attempt to ban large sugary drinks was something that really troubled her because in her family, the 16-ounce soda is shared by 8 children. So it became an economic issue, not a diabetes or obesity issue. Mm. When the citywide bus strike happened, she suddenly found herself having to walk her 3 youngest children to school. So she knew about it.
So as an investigative reporter, she is in your reach to be able to experience her world. Do you think the life that you live is out of Dasani's reach?
At the moment, I think it is. I think this is a child who's capable of anything. So moving the conversation a little bit away from her, she's an extraordinary child, and to the broader population she represents, what's become clear to me is that school is absolutely essential. School is a substitute home for homeless children. And it really, in terms of all of the supports in place, to my mind, the thing that is most anchoring, that is most important. And if she has a shot or her homeless peers have a shot, it's because these schools will get them through. But homelessness brings very, very traumatic experiences to children, and the odds are stacked against them.
You said there are details of Dasani's life that you could not have imagined until you experienced it as a reporter. Can you imagine an arena filled with 22,000 homeless kids like Dasani looking at all of them simultaneously?
I have often thought about that, and it is in the story for that reason, because it helps to try to visualize it, and it's overwhelming to think about. The number of homeless children when Mayor Bloomberg took office was about 13,000, so it's substantially larger, and it was at a crisis point then.
And the snow's falling today. We're going to get 5 inches, and in that cold and vulnerability, your thoughts go to Dasani.
Yes, they do. Very much so.
It'd be a cold walk home from school for her.
She is a very tough kid. I don't know how she manages, but she does. She just has enormous capacity to roll with the punches and survive. It's really a survival thing. And it's an intuitive kind of intelligence that I think, and people who have observed her in school think, really is a combination of rare smarts and life experience.
Andrea Elliott, investigative reporter for our partner, The New York Times. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Andrea Elliott's series on that homeless family in New York is running all week in The New York Times. One of you in Atlanta, Georgia writes us, the U.S. should now stand for and protect against economic injustice, institutionalized racism, and sexism in the workplace. That thought part of a conversation you've started with the passing of Nelson Mandela and the work left undone. What work should be focused on in America right now? From Baton Rouge, Louisiana, the U.S. administration should speak candidly about the skepticism felt towards Nelson Mandela at first. The message of Mandela is believing in yourself, your people, and your cause, even when no one else believes. Shattering oppression takes vigilance. Tell us what you think at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Be a part of the conversation. Find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.